Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
A new book that's came out just in March here, and it's Soldiers, or Soldier, Sailor, Frogman, Spy, Airman, Gangster, Kill or Die. And it's how the Allies won on D-Day. So joining us is Giles Milton. Thank you for being here.
Giles. You're going to have to get this right.
Yeah. Well, welcome, Giles.
Well, thank you very much. No one can pronounce my name. It's Giles, but I'll go with anything you want to call me.
Well, you know, the French-Canadian, I just want to go Gil.
Giles, do not let him get away with this.
Giles, I'll see what I can do.
We have to get that right. Now, so what brought you to writing about this subject and about D-Day, World War II, and actually putting all the time and work into writing this book? Like, what led you to
that? Well, when I was previously working as a journalist, I covered every 10th anniversary of D-Day. And I first covered it in 1994, which was, of course, the 50th anniversary. And my newspaper sent me out to Normandy to meet and interview members of the French Resistance, who were really helping the Allies in the planning of D-Day by spying on the Germans, the German defense on the coastline. So I met a wonderful cast of characters, really sort of larger-than-life personalities, who played a really critical role and have never really been written about at all. And so I think that's what first got me going. And of course, this year being the 75th anniversary, I thought this would be a great time to really step back from the history of it and look at the individuals, the young soldiers who were sent ashore, you know, 17, 18 years old, on the 6th of June 1944, sent ashore into the German gunfire and see what they actually achieved, what they did on that day.
So you say 75 years. How many people are still around from this D-Day? Because 75 years, they've got to be in their 90s.
Yeah, there are. Amazingly, there's quite a few still left, I mean still alive. There are about 300 are sailing from Britain to Normandy for the celebrations on the 6th of June. And I think there are even more coming from America. So they're all in their 90s. And in fact, I was in Normandy just last week, and we took a 93-year-old back to Gold Beach, one of the landing beaches, to where he landed there at dawn on the 6th of June. Extraordinary to take him back there, and he was describing, he remembered everything, what it was like to land under German machine gun fire. You know, his best friend died in his arms at the top of the beach. He lived through a nightmare, and he said on that beach, he said, you know, this has been with me every day of my life.
Yeah, it's quite an event. I think that the a thing, you know, I noticed in when I'm in the UK a lot, you know, you guys have a lot of television and programs about the war and about history. When you come to North America, especially in the States, there's very little. You know, there's particular shows or movies, but it's not like, it's not the same thing. And I think a lot of younger people have quite a distance between, I mean, if you're born in the 90s or 2000 and you're 20 or so, you don't really have a connection to World War II like perhaps some of us did.
Well, that's so true. I mean, and also, you know, for a lot of us Brits, it was pretty close to home. So my mother lived in southeast London, which was heavily bombed throughout the war. And her you know, the first sort of 10 years of her life was just endless bombing raids, going down into the subway to get away from it. And so she really lived through that. And I guess, you know, your parents passed it on. So that was part of my childhood, was just hearing about the war and how awful it was.
Yeah, and growing up in Canada as young, all we had was a British television show and a CBC, and it was all World at War and Remembrance Day and all that sort of stuff. So it had an impact on me. I just wonder, people, I don't think the people realize how tough it really was, and on the UK, you didn't have, like, you guys were on rations, and during that time, it was really a tough time for people to live.
Yeah, I mean, the food, you know, my mother talking about the lack of food. They were constantly hungry. And by the end of the war, my grandmother, who obviously tried to save everything for the children, was just almost a skeleton at the end of the war. Britain was incredibly impoverished. It was, the population was half starving, and it was in a really bad way. And what's absolutely fascinating is when you read the British accounts of the American GIs coming over in preparation for D-Day, they just couldn't believe how well equipped, how well clothed, how much food they brought with them. It just seemed like they had luxuries sort of pouring out of every pocket. And there are so many accounts of this sort of amazement when these well-equipped Americans arrive in Britain, you know, in 43, 44.
Hi, Giles, it's me. But when I was just listening to your account of your mother, and yeah, my grandmother spent vast amounts of time in Chislehurst tunnels. Again, you know, with you know, escaping the bombing in Kent, and we've been a military family, so attending many of the remembrance services that have been held over some years, and I was just, I suppose, interested in the point that Al made, that less and less people are aware of what life was like, and I think there is an element of that, but I also think there's a lot of people that keep memories alive. And you see more and more young people taking part now in the remembrance services. So we have all of our Boy Scouts, our Girl Guides, our Brownie groups, our, you know, youth groups, including the Forces youth groups. And so I think it's something that we try to keep alive, isn't it? But it's really hard to help very privileged children nowadays understand what it's like to live through a war zone.
I think that's very true. But I also think there becomes a shift when the generation who fought in the war finally pass away. So we had this not that long ago with the First World War, when the last soldier who fought in the First World War died. And really, suddenly, the First World War really enters the history books then. And, you know, we're not far off from that with D-Day. Like Al said, you know, the veterans are all in their 90s, and it will not be very long before D-Day and the Second World War has also passed into history, and it becomes a different, more difficult, I think, to keep the all of that alive when there are no survivors left to tell the tales.
Because then I guess we enter into the realms of we're remembering memories, and that's much more difficult to keep it raw and alive and real, isn't it?
I think it is. And I suppose the difference, there is a difference between Britain, of course, and the States, whereas, like you're saying, Britain, London, the southeast of England particularly, was seriously badly hit by German bombing raids. And, my mother used to be able to, she used to do the noises of the V1 rockets coming over and the V2 rockets coming over. And, these terrifying sounds that haunted her childhood. So a lot of people really had a vivid experience, a very unpleasant experience of the war, which I suppose never really happened in North America.
So for the purposes of our American friends, because predominantly, we have an American audience, how did it all begin? What was life like from, being a family living in London one day to the change that was the war the next day?
Well, of course, war was declared in 1939, but it was labelled by an American politician the phony war, when nothing much happened for quite a long time. And it wasn't until the spring of May 1940, when Hitler invaded, Holland, Belgium and France, and suddenly things get really serious, because Churchill, who becomes Prime Minister at exactly this time, he knows that Hitler is intending to invade Great Britain. Operation Sea Lion was the German code name for the invasion of Great Britain. And suddenly, I read an account of Hitler, of Churchill speaking to Roosevelt and saying, "We're expecting the invasion any day now." And suddenly, Britain, which was completely ill-equipped to fight against this huge sort of Nazi army, suddenly finds itself in desperate trouble. And there was a big question is it going to support Britain, and how is it going to do so? At the beginning, it was the support was not very visible, but obviously gradually as the war went on, and of course then America enters the war, everything changes. Churchill's great plan was to get America to fight in Europe and not initially to fight in the Far East, and that was probably his great triumph of politics, was to persuade the Americans to do that, and that leads all the way through really to D-Day in 1944.
And of course recently there's been numerous films made about Churchill's life, depicting him in many ways, and very powerful films actually.
Yeah, a lot of them have been really, really brilliant. I mean, one of the best portrayals of Churchill, I think, was in The Crown, which I know has been incredibly popular in America. Another great portrayal was Darkest Hour, where Gary Oldman played Churchill brilliantly again. I mean, there was one ridiculous scene, of course, which was Churchill travelling on the metro, on the subway, the London subway, which, of course, Churchill, from a very privileged background, he never, ever in his life took public transport. And so there was a slightly ridiculous scene, but, it worked in terms of the film. And generally, the film, I thought, was an excellent portrayal of this figure who really pulled a desperate, impoverished and half-starved country through the war.
I remember attending the Step Short Parade in Folkestone a few years ago, and just understanding that these very young and influential young men were marched to the top of the hill, and then they were full of hope, full of life, ready to go and fight for their country. And walking down that hill where the Step Short command was given, and watching people come back, critically wounded, and the morale being so low, and much fewer people coming back up that hill than went down.
Yeah.
And it really struck an emotional chord within me, just imagining these very young men. Just full of hope and wanting to go and fight. They were keen. Many of them really wanted to go and support the country.
I know. When you see the photos of some of these, they look like school kids. Well, I guess a lot of them actually were. They were 17. And, Al mentioned, Canada there. Of course, the Canadians were all volunteers. There was no conscription. So, the entire assault force on D-Day that landed on Juno Beach was entirely a volunteer force. Quite extraordinary, really.
Well, how many actually were involved in the battle, and how many people did we lose? Like, how many people on both sides?
Yeah, so on D-Day itself, the plan, which was successful, was to land 156,000 men on D-Day, on the 6th of June, and they were to be followed over the next sort of month and a half, by 2 million more men. So it's massive amounts of, you know, this was on a scale, a seaborne invasion on a scale that had never been done before in the history of warfare. It involved 7,000 ships, 12,000 planes, you know, enormous numbers of paratroopers. 13,000 American paratroopers dropped into Normandy that night. The casualty rate was large, but it was not as horrific as some of the planners had thought. There were about 10,000 casualties on D-Day. That was on the Allied side. That's killed and wounded. German casualties, we really don't know. There are no accurate figures at all. The estimates have been between 4,000 and 10,000, which is such a divergence. It's, you know, a bit pointless, really. The casualties that never get mentioned, and which I wanted to talk about a little bit in my book, was the French civilians, because you've got to remember that coast of Normandy is dotted with little seaside fishing villages, and no one had left their homes. They were all their families, you know, housewives, children, whatever. They were all there, and they found themselves on the 6th of June under the heaviest naval bombardment ever. And so they suffered enormous casualties, and it is possible that, in fact, more French civilians died on D-Day than troops from all the other nations put together, but we'll probably never know that for sure.
Yeah, I guess that they would have no idea. It's not like they were going to promote when they were doing this. So,
no, it was literally about half an hour before the bombardment started. The Allied planes dropped leaflets from the sky just saying, get out of your homes, get into the fields, just get away from the coast. But, of course, you know, it was just far too late by then. So, so sadly, tragically, you know, an awful lot of people lost their lives because of that.
Now, your title's very interesting. How did you come up with the title? Like, what made you choose those words?
Well, I've got to be completely honest here. The title of the British edition is simply D-Day, the Soldier's Story. And when I was in New York, I had a meeting with the sort of senior people from Barnes & Noble, and they said, no, come on, your book's full of just all these amazing characters. Can't you get that across in the title? So I thought, well, we could. I almost suggested as a joke, I said we could go wild and just put some of these, you know, put them on the title, these soldier, sailor, frogman, spy, you know, let's put them all in. And they just said, oh, that's great, that really works. So that's how it came about. over a long lunch in New York, a long and very nice convivial lunch in New York, yes, we said.
Yeah, must have been some martinis in there, I don't know. Oh, that's interesting. That's so you really approached the story from people's own specific memories of it, don't you?
Yeah, the entire book is drawn from original accounts, testimonies, interviews, diary extracts, letters, and etc. So this involved a lot of research in quite a few different countries. So obviously America, but in Germany, in France as well, and in my own country, in Britain. But in America, the archives were absolutely brilliant, because although you said, you know, a lot of people don't have much, they often don't know a lot about the war. Down in New Orleans, you've got the National Second World War Museum, and not only is it enormous, but it's absolutely brilliant, and they have all the archives from D-Day there. So I was able to read, you know, the accounts of the men who landed in the first wave on Omaha Beach, on Utah Beach. It's just amazing when you read these accounts. And the other place I went to in America, which was great, was in Ohio, is the Cornelius Ryan Archive. Now, some of your listeners will know that he wrote The Longest Day, which was, you know, a huge bestseller in the 50s, and then became a big Hollywood movie. Cornelius Ryan interviewed hundreds, if not thousands, of veterans, and many of the accounts were never used in his book, because actually his book is very short. And so I had that full access to all of these accounts from not just Americans, but he interviewed a lot of Germans as well, because I wanted to include the German side of the story in my book. And so that was just fascinating, again, to read the Germans who suddenly realize, you know, on the night of the 6th of June, they suddenly realize, my God, this is it. This is what we've been waiting for. And it's now happening. And the absolute panic that took place, you know, amidst the German ranks. So, you know, to look at these original sources is a real eye-opener. You get the full sort of horror and color of what it was like.
And so when you talk about that, and when you see these testimonies, so to speak, written by people, what was their thought on death? Were they really thinking they were, you know, like, what was their thought process? Were they thinking, this is it, I probably won't see tomorrow type thing? Was it kind of a
It was very emotional. There were the battle speeches by the commanders to try and, you know, pump up the men and everything. But once they set sail, and you've got to remember, of course, the night of the 5th, 6th June was one of the stormiest nights in the English Channel for years. It was absolutely atrocious weather. So within an hour or so of setting sail, most of the men were violently seasick and feeling absolutely terrible, which did very little to boost their mood as they were preparing to go into battle. They wrote letters to their loved ones. They told their friends what to say to their wives and their girlfriends if they didn't make it back. It was a really emotional time, and a lot of them really thought they were not going to pull through. What was going to be, they knew, a very tough assignment. Because, you know, to send infantry onto a shore which is heavily defended with machine guns and shells and mortar shells, God knows what, they really thought they weren't going to come through. So, you can feel the raw emotion in many of the accounts that they left, you know, that they wrote down.
So was this battle really going to be the one that won or lost it for the Allies?
This battle, D-Day itself, that one day, 6th of June, 44, was absolutely crucial, a crucial turning point in the Second World War, because if the Allies succeeded in landing and creating a beachhead in northern France, it was almost certain that they would win the Second World War. Even Rommel, who was in charge of the German army in France, even he said that if the Allies carve out a beachhead, they're going to win the war, because by carving out that beachhead, they can then land enormous amounts of material and men and simply drive forwards across France and into Germany. So Rommel understood that the stakes were absolutely, at their very, very highest. But it should be said, if the Allies had failed on D-Day, if they'd been pushed back into the sea, it would have been a complete catastrophe, because who knows when they could have launched another invasion. It probably wouldn't have been for another year. They would have lost all element of surprise. And don't forget, the Soviet Red Army was advancing from the east as well and making really rapid progress. So who knows what the shape of Europe would have been, had D-Day not been a success. I mean, the Soviets might have overrun most of Europe by that point, by the time they could have launched another invasion. So, critical times. Famously, Eisenhower wrote two messages to be broadcast, or one of which was to be broadcast at the end of the 6th of June. One of them said, the landings have been a success, our lads have succeeded in creating a beachhead. And the other, which thankfully was never used, said, our landings have failed, the responsibility is mine alone, admitting defeat. That one, that message, happily remained in his jacket pocket, and he was able to proclaim that they had been a success. But yes, this was a high-stakes game, and everyone knew it.
Now, so the movie Saving Private Ryan, that's probably one of the most popular. The beginning part with the battle when they're landing and all the people that got killed, do you find that a pretty accurate depiction?
Yes and no. In fact, when in the film, and a lot of people have said, God, it really shows you the horrors of war. And in the film, they come ashore, the American troops come ashore into a maelstrom of gunfire and God knows what. It's absolutely murderous. In fact, the reality was slightly different. The very first landing craft to land on Omaha Beach, they landed into almost silence. It was a sort of deathly hush on the beach. They clambered ashore. The man in charge of the landing, the flotilla, radioed back to the big fleet anchored offshore and said that they have landed safely on Omaha Beach. And it was only once they were on the beach, completely exposed, that suddenly the German machine gun fire opened up. So and then the massacre began. So in essence, Saving Private Ryan got it right, but in detail, it was slightly different from how it's portrayed.
Wow. Is there a particular a film depiction that you would deem the most accurate, Giles?
It's difficult. I think. I mean, I would probably go with Saving Private Ryan because it does bring across the horrors.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Of what it was like to land in the first wave. And you know, I read so many accounts. I mean, unfortunately, most who did land in the first wave didn't survive. But I think it brings out just the level of carnage that there was. But it should be remembered, of course, that Omaha Beach was, of course, you know, the worst beach of all. Forever afterwards known as Bloody Omaha because it was so horrendous. But other beaches were relatively light casualties. I mean, Utah Beach, another American landing beach, this is an extraordinary fact. More servicemen were killed in the practice for Utah, the landing on Utah Beach, which took place in the west of England. More were killed in the practice run than were killed in the actual landings. So, you know, not every beach was the same by any stretch of the imagination, and Utah was probably one of the easiest of the five beaches that the men landed on that day.
I was just having a look, actually, at some of the figures in terms of the landings, and I was looking at the Imperial War Museum's figures.
Yeah.
And it talks about, you know, across the beaches, less than a week later, on June the 11th, the beach is fully secured. And just to get some sort of idea of scale here, 326,000 troops, more than 50,000 vehicles and 100,000 tons of equipment had landed within 1 week. That is massive, isn't it?
It's absolutely enormous. And as I said, that figure of men, right, it rises to 2 million very soon afterwards.
Yeah.
Now, one of the most amazing stories about D-Day is the problem that the Allies faced is they were not going to be able to capture a big port or a big harbour on D-Day, and they really needed a big harbour to land all this stuff. So what did they do? They had a rather brilliant idea. They decided to tow one over from England. In fact, tow two over from England. They built these enormous floating concrete harbours, these sort of enormous concrete caissons, which they towed over, and then these were all linked together when they were brought to the shore of Normandy, and they created these massive harbours that enabled them to land all the stuff. And they called them Mulberry Harbours. As I say, I was in Normandy last week. It's quite amazing because they were designed to last a couple of months. There's still quite a lot of the bits of the harbour, these floating concrete caissons, are still there in the sea. They're still afloat. So 75 years on, it's quite extraordinary.
I was going to say, now that the landing and the beach fight was one aspect, but then they still had to go on land and clear a lot of the towns. That must have been pretty... That would have been just as difficult, if not more, in a different way, right?
It was really, really tough. I mean, the target for D-Day was wildly ambitious. You know, they were meant to capture the city of Bayeux. They were meant to capture the city of Caen. They were never going to be able to do this. In fact, Caen wasn't captured for many, many weeks after D-Day, and it's only a few miles inland from the coast. But what happened, you see, on D-Day that slowed everything down was that in the afternoon of D-Day, the German panzer divisions got on the move and they started to counterattack. If they had attacked when the Allies started landing at dawn on D-Day, they could have caused absolute mayhem. But Hitler did not sanction them to go into action until noon, and they didn't actually get into action until later in the afternoon, which meant that the Allies at least managed to get a toehold on the land before the counterattack came from the Germans. But had they not counterattacked, they would have made much greater progress inland. But I think the furthest any Allied soldier got inland was about 7 miles from the coast. So it was a pretty precarious toehold they had by the end of that day. And on Omaha, which, you know, as we've been saying, was a really tough battle to get ashore, by the end of the day, they were only 2,000 yards inland. So really just clinging on to their little beachhead.
I was just interested in, I work in a field where a lot of investigations have got operational names, and there's no different. The military use operational names for many of their assaults, investigations or interventions in any way. And so for D-Day, we had Operation Overlord, which was the Allied invasion. That then turns into Operation Neptune, which becomes the assault phase and landing troops. And then the Battle of Normandy, which is then kind of from that point onwards.
Yes, there were distinct elements, absolutely, to the operation. Yeah, and they were broken down and very carefully planned, all of them, yeah.
And in terms of those, the planning, you know, in films we see that as in their kind of underground bunkers and Churchill making these plans with his very, you know, close acquaintances and colleagues. Do you think that's a fair depiction? It was kind of really kind of cloak and dagger stuff and planned in quite that meticulous way, or do you think sometimes this was more about reactions because of the nature of what they were challenged by?
Well, no, you can still see, I mean, they still exist, the plans for D-Day, and they were absolutely extraordinary. Every single minute is accounted for, which regiment would land where. It is unbelievably detailed. But the one major problem that occurred on D-Day is that, you know, the plans went wrong almost before the troops had landed on the beaches. Everything went wrong. The timings went wrong. The tides and the strong currents pushed the boats into places they weren't meant to land at. There was a huge reliance on telecommunications, wireless communications, and of course all the equipment got wrecked in the salt water, so there were no communications. everything went wrong. I mean, it's an old sort of adage that, you know, everything goes wrong on contact with the enemy, and that certainly happened on D-Day. So despite, although they had this incredibly well-planned operation, nothing actually went according to plan on the day, which meant that the fate of D-Day, and this is really the point of my book, is the fate of D-Day was in the hands of those young men who landed, in the first few hours of that day. They had to basically take the initiative and try and win victory when everything, all the plans they trained by had gone wrong.
If you don't mind, I'd like to just talk and capture a little bit about the psychological impact of war and leading then into the differences today or mm-hmm. perception of difference. Because at that time, we have all, if we look back, we can look back quite fondly at some of the music from Dame Vera and yep. how that was rallying the troops and really rallying those left behind to have faith in their men, to wave them goodbye with a smile and welcome them back when they come back. But the emotional impact on families was, you know, all of these young guys, all of these men were just going to vanish, leaving a population of many women trying to kind of hold the reins, then being drafted into the workforce and the sociological aspects of change that happened in terms of our views on childcare and what children need, that the political agenda changed to allow that to happen, if you like.
Yeah.
So, you know, and now we're in a situation, you know, and I've heard this said, I'm not saying this is my view, where we've had men go to war and we are now more aware of the emotional trauma. We have PTSD. We have a diagnosis, something that we can say this is the cause and this is how it's helped. How do you make sense of that, given all of those things that those individuals suffered in World War One and Two? And the complete lack of understanding and recognition about what they may have gone through.
Yeah, well, you know, just having talked to this chap, this old soldier, Harry Bellinge, who we took back to Gold Beach the other day, he landed under heavy gunfire. His best friend was killed very close to the beach, died in his arms. He then fought his way through France. He fought for the next few months. And eventually, he simply collapsed of nervous fatigue, of exhaustion, a condition that was completely not taken seriously at all. He was taken back to England, and by the time he recovered, the war was over. But he said to me, you know, there was no support at all for this post-traumatic stress. And, you know, we hear about it all the time now, soldiers coming back from Afghanistan and everything. There was simply no support. It was the sort of the British, you know, stiff upper lip mentality, you know, get a grip on it, man, and pull yourself together, have a nice cup of tea. And so it was really awful for them. And they had and they've had to live with that for the rest of their lives. And I think from what I've read, I'd say that sort of 95% of those who landed on D-Day and afterwards were absolutely terrified out of their brains. Yeah. And there were about 5%. For them, it was the time of their lives. They were suddenly found themselves equipped with heavy weaponry. They could kill anyone they wanted. They could cause mayhem. There were no rules, and they loved it. But that was very, very much the exception to the rule. Most of them were very, very scared indeed.
And I think, I've heard it said now, you know, about current resources and support that goes to our military personnel now. And I've heard people say, well, what's all this need now? Why do we need all this now? There were people in World War II that didn't get this stuff. They manned up. They were okay. But, of course, it's now about our recognition. And those people in World War II were deeply infected and impacted throughout their whole lives. You know, people don't retain that detail of memory throughout their whole lives about events unless it's a very significant and traumatic injury. And we just didn't recognise it, did we, at the time? It was, as you said, that stiff upper lip.
Yep. I mean, Harry said to me he had the images and the sounds in his mind, in his head, every single day of his life. So he's had to live with that ever since 1944. You know, and he is by no means alone. That is what most of those young men had to go through. And horrific, really, with no backup and no support.
And how did it impact, do you think? I mean, we know that on those left behind and the children who were evacuated, were you able to, through the survivors of World War II, have get some insight into how they managed their families separating and then the trauma that that impacted upon the children?
Well, you know, yeah, I mean, what we tend to forget is because, you know, we focus on D-Day, and certainly the 75th in that coming up very soon will focus on the day itself. But we kind of forget that these men were away for absolutely ages. They were away for months and months on end. So it led to very fragmented family lives, you know, relationships ended, particularly in times of great emotional stress. Relationships just fell apart. You know, often children had been sent off into the countryside, children from cities anyway, to where they were slightly safer, but it meant they didn't see their parents for, not only they didn't see their father, but they didn't see their mother for months on end as well. So an extraordinary sort of social impact on family life. And like you said as well, for women as well, women's roles completely changed in a very short space of time. You know, the traditional role of the woman, the housewife at home doing the cooking and the shopping, etc. Suddenly, these women were working massively long shifts in factories, building weapons and playing an absolutely crucial role in the war. So I think after the war, it was very difficult. Things couldn't go back to how they were. It was just, it had been such a profound social upheaval for people. And of course, in the south of England, for all the Brits in the south of England, to see this huge influx of Americans who had a completely different way of life or a different way of looking at things, it was, you know, a remarkable and radical change, I think.
And alongside that, we saw also, I mean, I work in with children, and we saw the to allow those things to happen, we saw the different research about attachment for children with their parents. Do they have to be with the mother? Of course they don't have to be, which allowed women to go out to work. It almost gave them permission that their child wouldn't suffer if they were able to leave them. And then we saw people coming back and they wanted their jobs back. So yeah, then the pendulum swung again. And it's when you're looking at it in a much broader sense, the impact of across the nations, and plural, was horrific.
Yes. And, you know, I wrote a previous book about guerrilla warfare and sabotage in the Second World War, and women played a very key role in special operations and the SOE, the Special Operations Executive that Churchill set up. And one of the key women was called Joan Bright, and she ended up really being a sort of PA, to a personal assistant to Churchill. And she actually says at one point, and it's very interesting, she said, "I saw myself as being in the vanguard of a feminist revolution." So she very much saw this as a turning point, as a landmark moment for women and women's lives, and how that it was never going to be the same again. And she went on, like so many who worked in special operations and who worked in Bletchley Park, the great, you know, eavesdropping centre, code-breaking centre, and they went on to play major roles and have powerful jobs for the rest of their lives. So for some people, it really was, you know, it was a turning point.
And we saw that in the recent film with Benedict Cumberbatch in The Imitation Game, where they cracked the Enigma code, and where you know, a female was appointed into a place of, you know, research and maths and then very early computer science that never have happened before, and she had to tell her parents that she was going to do other activities. She couldn't possibly have been working with these men in this room. It'd be completely inappropriate.
I know, it's extraordinary. And the funny thing, I mean, it's funny now, is that a lot of these women, they all had to sign the Official Secrets Act, and they considered that because they signed that, they could never talk about what they'd done during the war until their dying days, and many of them never spoke about it because, no, well, they'd signed the Official Secrets Act. Happily, there were a few who broke out of that and did tell their stories, which enables us to piece together the extraordinary work they did at Bletchley Park, and it should be said, many, many other places as well. They did play a really crucial role, and it really ought to be written about more, actually.
I mean, I for one certainly don't feel that. I mean, when I was at school, there was nothing in our history lessons about World War II or One. And I've, you know, all of my learning in that has been through my own parents and throughout adult lives. So yeah. I definitely think there should be a lot more teachings around, you know, where we've come from and what we owe others in terms of sacrifice. But also understanding the bigger impact on society and how we've evolved as a result of our freedom from that war. It's astounding, really. Really astounding.
I think also you get very different narratives. You know, if you read a British history of D-Day, they tend to be very much from the British perspective, and the Americans hardly get mentioned. And likewise, if you read American histories of D-Day, like sort of by Stephen Ambrose, is a, you know, famous writer, he hardly mentions the British. And I felt this was completely unfair on how D-Day panned out, because of course it was an amazing international operation, and you know, we've talked about the first wave of men landing on Omaha Beach, which was the American beach. But in fact, the man that led these troops to the beach was actually a British, he was a Royal Navy guy. So there was a lot of crossover, and I think it's important to remember that it was the Brits, the Americans, the Canadians, but also the French, the Czechs, the Poles, the Norwegians, all of these nations played a part in D-Day, and that really does get written out of the story.
Absolutely.
Did you have any surprises, like when you were doing the research and reading and going through to do your book, were there any points where you were sort of surprised by something you learned?
I think the surprise was perhaps just when when I mentioned that 5% were kind of adventurers who actually took some enjoyment in the thrill of war. So one of the great stories of D-Day is the story of the Rangers climbing up Pointe du Hoc, this amazing operation where they had to scale the cliffs. And these James Rudder's Rangers, as they were known, they really they trained for this moment. They were looking forward to it. A lot of them were from fairly rough, sort of gangster-like families from various inner cities in America. And they were heavily armed, and they were, had kind of, to use the cliched term, licensed to kill. And they just wanted to get on with it, and they wanted to prove that they could be, as a band of men, they could outdo anything that the Germans could do. So you get that with the Americans at Pointe du Hoc, with the Rangers, and you get it with the British commandos as well, who likewise felt that they were an elite band, and they wanted to live up to every sort of inch of that eliteness. And so that sort of took me quite by surprise, because I was sort of expecting the obvious narrative of everyone's, you know, absolutely terrified. But for some of them, no, they really saw this as an opportunity just to go for it, and boy, did they.
And when you were reading the German fighters' memoirs and stuff, what was their point of view in general? Like, what was the thought on their side?
Well, there's two very different points of view, depending on which accounts you read. So if you take the elite, the specialist SS Panzer divisions, the Panzer soldiers, they were highly trained, they fought on the Eastern Front, they knew what they were doing, and they kind of relished the fight ahead. It was a very, very different story for the young conscripts, 17 years old, 18 years old, on the beaches, in the bunkers. They were the ones going to be confronting or meeting head on the Americans, the Brits, the Canadians coming ashore. And, you know, I read some very, very poignant accounts. One chap, Carl Wegner, he was stationed on Omaha Beach, and he describes the absolute terror when he looks out through the aperture of his concrete bunker, and he sees wave after wave after wave of American landing craft coming into Omaha Beach. And he's so terrified, so frozen in panic, that he can't even fire his gun. And he describes how his commanding officer has to smash him over the head, over his helmet, with his pistol butt, to sort of bring him back to life and get him to fire his gun at the American troops landing. So, you know, it was not a pleasant experience for those troops. They were very similar to the Allies in the sense that they didn't want to be there. They were unwilling conscripts. And they had a very, very profound fear that they were going to be killed as the Allied troops came ashore. And I think it's really important to get the two, you know, those two voices across that, and that the Germans, many of the Germans, were not that different from many of the Americans and many of the Brits. They did want to be there.
Hmm. And so, what do you hope people get out of reading your book? What do you want them to take away?
Well, you know what? What I wanted to do was give voice to the voiceless, if you like, the voices that have never been heard. So much has been written about D-Day. There are endless books. And many of the sort of first-hand accounts are written by the generals, the officer class, those who planned D-Day, and those who often were not there on D-Day. What I wanted to do is tell the story of those who were there in the front, in the first wave, who really D-Day was going to be won or lost by them. And a lot of them felt at the end of the war that they felt slightly bitter about the fact that their roles had been completely written out of the story. And so I suppose one of the aims of my book is to give voice to those young lads, basically.
Fascinating. Great book. Do you have a website or anything, any information that you'd like to give out to the listeners if they want to find you or contact you or maybe pass on some information?
Absolutely. I'd love to hear from anyone. My website is very simple. It's www.gilesmilton.com. And if they want to check me out on Twitter, I'm at GilesMilton1. And I've been putting a lot of stuff on D-Day, out about D-Day recently, and I've been doing a lot of broadcast and a lot of articles, and they'll find that all on my Twitter handle.
Fantastic, and we're going to have it on our website as well. So the listeners that want to pick up the book, just one click away from the player there, you'll see it right below it. Fantastic. Well, again, it's been a real pleasure having you on, Giles. And,
I'm delighted. It's really kind of you to have me on. It's always great to talk about these little known stories, you know, and make sure that people know just what those young men did on the beach that day.
Yeah, I think it's very important. We like to cover a lot of history on the show, and I don't see it enough, especially over here. So it's fascinating to have you, and thank you.
Well, thank you very much as well. Thanks.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.